Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're jumping into a game that has had, I think it's fair to say, one of the most chaotic development cycles in recent memory.
Oh, for sure.
We're talking about Metroid Prime 4, Beyond. And our sources on this are really fascinating, not just reviews, but a deep technical breakdown and some insider perspectives. So our mission for you is to get the full story on why this game, which was announced, then totally scrapped, and publicly rebooted.
A huge deal at the time.
Why it ended up being what some are calling a flawed masterpiece. We're giving you the shortcut to understanding all that drama and the pretty incredible tech behind it.
And you really have to start with that drama. I mean, back in 2017, it was just a logo. That was it.
Just a logo, yeah.
Then comes 2019, and Nintendo issues this public apology saying they're starting over and giving it back to Retro Studios, the original team. That just... it doesn't happen.
It was a huge admission of failure, but also it was a promise, right? It was them invoking that famous philosophy.
That's it. A delayed game is eventually good, but a rushed game is forever bad.
And the pressure on Retro to actually deliver on that, I mean, years later in 2025, it must have been immense.
Absolutely. But the sources are clear. The gamble paid off. The game, Beyond, is apparently polished to within an inch of its life.
Like, what does that mean in practice?
It means reviewers have found, like, zero bugs, no texture pop-in.
Yeah.
The level of optimization is, well, it's an anomaly in today's market. It's what happens when you let a team finish their work.
Okay, so let's unpack that. How did Retro modernize a formula that's two decades old while still keeping that very specific Prime feeling? Let's start with the setting, Planet Furos. How does it nail that sense of isolation?
Well, that isolation is just... it's the core DNA of the series. Samus is always alone. She's a silent hunter.
Right, in a world full of games with, you know, chatty AI sidekicks or constant radio chatter.
Beyond just doubles down on the silence. It's all about environmental storytelling. You are completely on your own.
So if Samus isn't talking, how is that story told? What are we actually finding on Vuros?
Vuros itself is the story. It's this beautiful, tragic place. It was the homeworld of a race called the Lamorne.
The Lamorne.
Yeah. And the sources describe them as these beings of pure energy. You piece together their story by scanning these ancient murals, these petrified, well, bodies scattered all over.
So you're an archaeologist, basically. What happened to them? What's the tragedy?
They were trying to transcend. They figured out the secrets of time, and they wanted to shed their physical bodies to exist as energy across, you know, different timelines.
But it went wrong.
It went horribly wrong. They were consumed by the very temporal energy they were trying to control. So the entire planet is this graveyard where time itself is broken.
So you're not just told the story. You have to earn it. That discovery process sounds like it really elevates the whole experience.
It absolutely does. And that atmosphere, that tension, is just perfectly amplified by the main antagonist, Silux.
Okay, now this is a deep cut. This is a thread from Metroid Prime Hunters back in 2006.
A thread that's been dangling for a very long time.
We knew he was a bounty hunter, hated the Galactic Federation. But why is he such a good foil for Samus here?
Because he's a dark mirror of her. He's managed to steal and reverse engineer top-tier Federation technology.
So he can mimic her abilities?
He can mimic everything, her speed, her weapons, even the morph ball. It creates this constant cat-and-mouse game, and the sources compare it to being hunted by the SAX in Metroid Fusion.
Wow. Okay, for anyone who doesn't know, the SAX was a perfect silent clone of Samus that just relentlessly pursued you. That comparison, that makes Silux sound like a genuine existential threat.
He is. You're not just fighting some alien monster. You're fighting a twisted version of yourself.
And to fight a shadow like that, Samus has to evolve. So let's get into the new arsenal. The core combat is still that lock-on, strafe, shoot dance we all know.
Right. The fundamentals are there. But Retro added two major game changers.
And the first one is the reason everyone's calling her Jedi Samus.
The psychic visor. You get it pretty early on. It's this weird crystalline upgrade that fuses with her suit. It runs on Aeon energy, which fans might remember from Samus Returns.
And it lets you interact with the world in a totally new way.
Totally. First ability, telekinesis. So you can literally rip the shields off of space pirates.
Oh, that's cool.
Or, you know, pull a distant platform over to you to cross a gap. It's very physics-based.
And the second ability sounds even more strategic. Time shift.
Time shift is a tactical masterpiece. You create this localized bubble where time slows way down. You can use it on fast enemies, obviously, but also on environmental hazards, like slowing down giant spinning fans so you can slip through.
The sources all point to one specific moment that sells the whole thing.
The missile trick.
The missile trick. You use time shift to freeze a boss's missile in midair.
And then you use telekinesis to grab it and just throw it right back at them.
That one interaction tells you everything you need to know about how much deeper the combat has become.
It adds this whole new layer of strategy. But we have to talk about the other big change, which is a lot more controversial.
This is the thing that makes it a flawed masterpiece.
This is the elephant in the room, the Viola hover cycle.
The first time Samus has ever had a ground vehicle. And it completely changes the map design. Those tight corridors are suddenly connected by these massive open zones.
The scale is huge. They're comparing these areas to Halo Infinite or Sonic Frontiers. And look, the sources say it looks amazing. Blasting across the red sands of Vieros at 200 miles an hour is a spectacle.
But tip. Yeah, there's always a but.
But it raises a huge question about what Metroid is. I mean, the series is built on claustrophobia, on intimacy. Mm. It's about checking every wall for a crack, you know, methodically learning a space.
Right. And blasting past potential secrets on a speeder bike is...
It's antithetical to the series' DNA. That's the quote one source used. It just breaks that meticulous pacing.
And it gets worse when they force you into vehicle combat section.
Mm-hmm. This is what's being called the Arkham Knight Batmobile Syndrome.
I know exactly what that means. A cool idea that gets overused.
Exactly. The on-foot combat is fluid and responsive, but the vehicle combat is apparently clunky. You're fighting these repetitive drone waves in sections that just feel like filler. It really drags down the second act of the game.
But they didn't go full open world, right? Retro found some kind of compromise.
They did. It's a hybrid structure.
Yeah.
You still have that classic Metroidvania progression. You know, you need the super missile to open the green door. That's all still there. The game is really saved by the dungeons.
Tell me about the vaults.
So the vaults are the traditional dungeons, and they are praised across the board. This is classic Retro Studios. Intricate, multi-layered puzzle boxes that make you use every single ability you have, old and new.
So they're tight, claustrophobic.
Dark, complex, all the things you want from a prime dungeon. So you get this really interesting rhythm.
I go from the big, open, almost empty desert.
Where you feel kind of vulnerable, into the tight, controlled challenge of a vault, where you feel like a master. That back and forth between tension and release is what makes it all work, despite the hover cycle issues.
Okay, let's pivot to the tech, because you can't talk about how this game looks without talking about the hardware. The analysis was done on a Nintendo Switch 2 dev kit.
Yes, and the sources are definitive. This is the showcase game for Nintendo's new custom upscaling chip, the DLSS equivalent.
For anyone listening, what does that actually mean?
Basically, it's AI-powered image reconstruction. The console doesn't have to strain itself rendering a full 4K image. It renders at a lower resolution, say 1440p, and then this dedicated chip uses AI to intelligently upscale it to a perfect 4K.
So you get higher resolutions and better frame rates for less power.
Exactly. It's the magic bullet. And on the Switch 2, when it's docked, you get two main modes.
Fidelity mode first.
Fidelity mode renders internally at 1440p and upscales to a pristine 4K. And it's not just resolution. It has genuine ray traced reflections on Samus's visor and on water.
Wow. Real ray tracing on a Nintendo console.
And global illumination. So light bounces realistically. If you shoot a plasma beam, the whole cavern glows and reflects that light properly. It's gorgeous. And it's a locked 60 frames per second.
Rock solid. But for the competitive players, there's performance mode.
Of course. Performance mode drops the resolution dynamically. It's usually between 1080p and 1440p, but it unlocks the frame rate to 120 frames per second.
120.
If you have a high refresh rate TV, the sources say the shooting feels like a high-end PC shooter. It's incredibly responsive, a massive change for a Nintendo game.
But here's the part that sounds like black magic. It still runs on the old Switch OLED model. From 2021.
It does, but with big compromises. It targets 720p 60 FPS docked, but it uses really aggressive resolution scaling so it can look quite blurry, and the load times are apparently four times longer.
Still, the fact that it runs at all is an achievement.
It's an incredible feat of optimization, yeah.
So, wrapping this all up, what's the final verdict here? Metroid Prime 4. Beyond sounds like a huge success, a generational leap.
It is. It's a solid 910. It is the technical benchmark for the Switch 2 at launch. The only real conflict is that structural one. The vehicle sections hold it back from perfection, and the open zones can feel a little empty.
But the core experience is there.
The core experience is better than ever. The new combat abilities, the environmental storytelling, It's all a massive triumph. It's worth the wait. It's worth the $70 price tag. And yeah, it's a reason to buy a Switch too.
That feeling of being deep underground, solving a puzzle, while that haunting synth music swells.
Unmatched. It's still completely unmatched.
It is. So what we've really uncovered here is a kind of tension. The game's biggest technical and visual leaps are only possible because of this new hardware, the Switch 2. Which leads to a final question for you to think about. Considering the series is built on claustrophobic intimacy, does the sheer power of a new console justify adding massive open zones, even if they sometimes dilute that core feeling of dense, meticulous exploration that fans have always loved? Something to mull over as we watch this classic franchise evolve.